This is the Education Gadfly Show.
I would probably be stealing stuff out of garbage cans, yeah.
And that you would have been totally then, huh?
Oh!
Joe can bleep that one out.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli, the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me welcoming my co-host, the Aflac Duck of the education policy community, Rick Hess.
Hey, Mike, how you doing?
Do you think that might have been the biggest stretch we've ever had?
I'm not even sure. Well, what in what context exactly?
Well, the guy who does the voice for the Aflac Duck got fired because he tweeted some, well, jokes that, you know, weren't so funny in light of the whole Japan thing.
I got it, but I've never actually tweeted.
Oh, that's true.
I don't know what you're missing out on.
Yeah, but you have, you know, you do push the line when you're blogging. You know, you are known to walk into a meeting and say bad words that, you know, other people might be considered insensitive.
Well, line pushing tweeting. Didn't I see that somebody sent me that you had a debate, another Twitter debate with Diane, right?
Well, that's a funny thing. So, I think I sent like two tweets on this topic about, she said that Duncan and Gates and the rest of them want to privatize American education. And I was like, Diane, well, name one person in the education reform world who really wants to privatize the schools. And I went back and forth with her on maybe two or three tweets. And then the Klonsky brothers made a big deal out of this, that they were engaged in a big tweet war with me over privatization. As I told them, look, if their definition of a public school is a school that employs public employee unions, fine. But, you know, I think, look, if it's a publicly funded, publicly accountable, and open to the public, it's public.
Mm.
Boom. Mm. All right. Lots to cover this week, Rick. I should say, it's not like you've been totally, working hard all the time now. I understand that that you spent your Monday afternoon having lunch with Andre Agassi.
That's true. He impressed me, man. Yeah. You never know. You know, you meet people like who've been hugely successful at something like sports or music or whatever. You never know. Like, you know, I would coast if I was them.
Yeah.
I got to say, this guy blew me away. We were sitting down. He's opening a charter school facilities fund.
Yeah.
$250 million. Sounds like he's got about filled. And the guy talking about this thing, it sounded like sitting down with like a Kevin Hall, I mean, or a Jim Pizer. The guy talked this thing through front to back. He was more coherent than three quarters of the folks you hear in the charter community who've been doing this, you know, their whole lives. He was talking about the finances smart.
Yeah. No, what I want to know, did he have that bandana around his head?
You know what? It was cool.
He was taking camera shots on?
I was the guy in the suit. I got to say, it was a weird experience. So I'm sitting there in a suit and tie, like, you know, like one of those guys. And he's sitting there with like his right hand guy, and they're in t-shirts, and he's got like some kind of like bone necklace thing going on, just being cool and cash.
Nice.
At the palm, you know, the palm. I'm like, man, how square did I feel?
Nice. Next time you're in Vegas, Rick's not going to make that same mistake again. All right, we got a lot to cover. Let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
Okay, guys. Question number one. This week, Fordham released a report analyzing PISA scores across the OECD nations. Let's talk about the findings and what their implications might be.
So this was just a little analysis that Janie Skull and I did, looking at the PISA scores. And we did a couple of things. One is, like others have, we broke them out by race to kind of look at what was interesting there. But we also looked at raw numbers in terms of taking the percentages and multiplying them by the number of students that are actually in the country and looking at how many high achievers and low achievers there are in each country. Well, it turns out when you look at it that way, because the U.S. is a huge country compared to the other OECD nations, we dominate at either end of the spectrum. We produce more high-achieving kids than any other OECD nation. In fact, I think we said more than maybe the U.K., Germany, and France combined. Of course, we also dominate at the low end, too. But I think this is an important perspective, because you hear all the time that we're getting beat internationally. These other countries are passing us by, you know, and yet you go to Harvard or you go to global corporations and you still see a lot of Americans in important positions. And this helps to explain it. I mean, we are really big. So we're in the middle of the pack when you say, you know, the percentage of our kids who might hit the high achieving mark. But we got a lot of people. Other thing is, you know, our white kids, you know, doing really well. I mean, compared to the rest of the world, white kids in reading are among the highest achievers. Asian American kids, very high. But one last tidbit, Rick, did you know that our country produces more high-achieving Hispanic students than high-achieving Asian students in raw numbers?
And that's what? Because the percentage of the population that's under 18, Latino, well, what's it about, 6 to 1, 7 to 1 ratio?
Probably something like that, yeah. There's a lot more Hispanic kids out there.
Mm-hmm.
So anyways, new perspective. I mean, do you buy this argument that it's important to look at the raw numbers too?
No.
Why not?
Because...
Well, you're just sitting there and looking, you know, being pleasant, being polite this whole time?
Yeah, pretty much.
Well, why is that important? I mean, it's not the only thing to look at, but isn't it an important perspective?
Nah.
Okay.
You got 300 million people. If you got 30 million who are doing well, the fact is, if you got 30 million that are doing well in Britain or France, and they got to carry 40 million people along with them,
yeah,
it's a ratio deal. In the U.S., you got 320 million, 310 million. You got 30 million got to carry along 280 million with them. That's a problem.
All right. That's interesting. Hey, one last bit. Did you know there are more high achieving African American kids than high achieving Finns? Isn't that fun?
Mike's been quoting this stat all week.
I love it.
Gets the same
We're
going
to go look at Finland. Like, Finland's tiny. It's like the size of my pinky finger.
That's the bigger issue, that all the countries that the, you know, that your common core buddies get most excited about.
Yeah.
The Finlands and Singapores, it's a real different proposition to build a system that's going to work really well for a homogenized nation with 1 or 2 million kids. This
right.
is a different proposition.
All right. Topic number two.
Joel Klein and Nicholas Kristof both put out thoughtful op-eds on how to reform the teaching profession this past weekend. Is it possible to push for teacher reform without alienating these same educators?
So this is a big question, Rick. Okay. I mean, there's a lot of talk in the articles about how teachers right now are feeling alienated. They're being blamed. They're the scapegoats. They feel attacked. Should we worry about that?
No, they should suck it up. I mean, this drives me crazy that you're not allowed to talk honestly about educational issues without somebody running around wringing their hands and saying it's not an attack. To say that tenure policies are problematic, to say that healthcare benefits or public employee collective bargaining are problematic, to talk about dysfunctionality in the way we compensate and evaluate teachers, is not to attack teachers. It's to say that we have built a dumb system that doesn't accomplish what we want.
Okay,
if teachers are going to choose to be offended by this, That's really, I mean, that's unfortunate.
All right. But one thing you hear is that, you know, this is creating an environment of fear out there, and that even good teachers now feel like, hey, we don't know if we're going to keep our jobs or keep our rights, and that will, you know, they'll run towards the open embrace of their teachers unions to protect them. I mean, is that something we need to be worried about?
Sure. And I mean, and it's unfortunate that you get these dunderheaded people who claim to, you know, who think of themselves reformers, who want to try to speak in language that vilifies the NEA and that vilifies the AFT, and people who won't actually conduct, you know, respectful or personal interactions with, you know, Van Roykel and with Randy, and people who won't bother to develop real relationships. That is a problem. And these people have done more harm than good by making themselves into avatars of, you know, of good, fighting forces of evil. But at the end of the day, we cannot allow ourselves to be afraid to talk honestly and bluntly because some teachers are going to be offended.
Wait, would you like to name the dunderheads, Rick?
I'm going to leave that to the listenership.
Affleck. Okay.
Okay, topic three.
The newest plan to save Detroit public schools, both financially and academically, is to convert 40 traditional district schools into charters. Is this latest attempt going to do the trick?
So what's this about?
I don't know. This doesn't make any sense to me.
It doesn't, right? I mean, No. First of all, it's quick. I mean, it's March now. We're saying by September, all of these schools are going to be charters.
Because the best charters involve the least planning, in my experience.
Yes.
It's best to find out 150 days before you open that you're actually going to be a charter.
Yep.
And then throw everything together in a hurry, because that has always worked well.
And it's particularly good if you want to take a dysfunctional school, you know, where there was a lot of animosity among the staff.
And a dysfunctional district where you're informing people that they're becoming a charter without much necessarily buying on their part, because these are the charters that we're often most proud of.
All right. So is this about getting around the teacher's contract? Is this about thinking that the Robert Bob or Bob to his friends can save money? I mean, what is this about?
I don't have a clue. I mean, I sure as hell hope it's not more of this thing where, you know, Obama and Duncan have been running around the country talking about how nifty charter schools are, and that people decided, hey, charter schools work. But I like to think somebody there has got a much more strategic vision, because at least what's been covered so far in the Ed Week places doesn't make a whole heck of a lot of sense to me.
All right. That's the time we got for Pardon the Gadfly. Thanks for playing, Daniela. Thanks for asking those good questions.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. It's now time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Welcome back to the show, Amber.
Thank you so much.
So, what is that you've got around your neck?
This would be a Murano glass Italian piece of jewelry that is very expensive. Thank you very much.
It looks like something Mr. T used to wear, too. I'm just saying.
It's got some gold in it.
Did you get it from an A-team, like nostalgia sale?
No, this was my aunt's. Thank you very much. Now I'm going to really make you feel really bad because my aunt passed away and left it to me. So how big do you feel now?
I just, for the listeners to be able to picture your aunt's bequeathed jewelry, it's like a leather bandolier with like a giant gold coin. Mm-hmm. I think Mr. T wore this in the episode where they went and sprung somebody from a Mexican prison.
The thing is that women have complimented me today on this.
It's cool.
Men do not. Women have. Danielle is in the back saying she likes it.
I like it very much.
It's like a gold medal that I might want to win at the Olympics someday.
I still remember I remember a pilot episode of A-Team. I was like 12. I remember it came on. I think it was after the Super Bowl, like back in 1980. Or so, I was like in that music, dun, 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 and it brings it to mind. So I dig your medallion.
Yeah, thank you very much. I'm going to take that as a compliment.
You should.
I am.
And our producer, Joe, has a Mr. T-like mohawk, so it all fits together.
Very true. And Danielle's got kind of the Mr. T attitude. She frightens me occasionally.
Okay, Amber. Top that.
Let's go.
Now that we've babbled on for 2 minutes, you've got one minute to cover education research.
All right. It's going to be a sad study this week. We've got the latest results from the merit pay program implemented in New York City. This is the Roland Fryer study. Our buddy Rick here has made a compelling case that these programs are awfully poorly conceived and don't address key concerns around redesigning the profession to help attract and retain teachers. And this study will not help matters. This NBR working paper, again, authored by Roland Fryer, it basically evaluated this program in approximately 400 schools, among which roughly half were randomly selected and offered treatment. Another 163 served as control schools. The half offered treatment, however, had to obtain majority vote on whether they'd participate. In the end, 16% declined. They pulled them from, they had a waiting list, blah, blah. Suffice it to say, there was a selection bias issue here that we won't go into, but the schools should have opted in before random assignment. Anyhow, on to the program. From 07 to 10, UFT and New York City Department of Ed agreed to provide bonuses of up to $3,000 to teachers whose schools achieve progress on their annual report card. Schools were free to divvy up money however they chose. Guess how many chose to distribute the bonuses equally? Quickly, I've got a minute.
Many.
80%.
Big shocker. The experiment led to no significant increases in student achievement, attendance, graduation rates, or teacher behavior. Whew. Moreover, and this is really, really bad, despite this lack of progress, guess how many schools in the study were awarded the maximum bonus in the second year?
80%.
There we go again. So one thing is clear, even though the performance measure was very complicated, this was kind of amusing, because progress was calculated relative to other schools, it meant that some schools could reach their progress targets if their peer school underperformed. So they didn't actually do anything. So what we have here is obviously not redesigning teacher pay, but a mechanism by which to award across the board bumps for all teachers.
So just to be clear, what we've got is a program whose performance measures were bizarre, which paid teachers based not on the team level or at the individual level, but just basically school-wide in most cases, and which was only remotely related or understandable to what they were actually doing in the classroom.
That's right.
Oh, swell. Well, I feel like I'm much more informed by this thoughtful study.
Yeah.
And the money was
$3,000
in New York City, which, you know, teachers are probably...
But thank God we used a modified random assignment because that's right. It doesn't matter what... This is what's insane about this, right? This research conversation. We have these bizarrely and stupidly configured interventions, and then people get very excited because they're able to use a random assignment approach to study a stupid intervention.
Yeah, but in this case, the random assignment wasn't even implemented well,
which is
so
a problem.
It's even worse. So,
all right, but the bigger bigger issue is this: that the school wide idea is a dumb idea, the bonuses weren't enough money, or it doesn't matter. The point is not to try to get a bump in test scores; it's to
attract better talent into the classroom, and the fact that you want to use dollars to reward people who are doing a bigger lift. And frankly, if you think about this, what you usually do is you want to measure people, the individual, for the stuff that they actually control. But you don't immediately want to go to the largest possible unit for everything else. If you run a United Way chapter, What you'd like to do is if people are in a unit, a marketing unit, a service unit, mm-hmm. you want, if you're going to do unit-based bonuses, you want to do it around their team because people have some ownership.
Right.
A grade level team makes a hell of a lot more sense than just immediately going school-wide for that, which doesn't make mm-hmm. sense at the individual level. It's bizarre.
Yeah. I just not look at additional responsibilities, productivity, any of those kind of things.
Right.
Look, I just think the whole conversation drives me crazy. We should be giving principals the authority to make these decisions on a case-by-case basis.
Well, this is what reformers are somehow think it's exciting that they've got these evaluations going. It's the most bizarre Pyrrhic mm-hmm. victory in history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I want a principal to be able to decide that when Mrs. Smith comes in and says, hey, I'm leaving for the school in another district because they offered me $10,000 more, that principal can make a decision and say, you know what? She's really good. I'm going to meet their offer. That's, none of that's allowable under these kinds of
rules. Public bureaucracies are bad at permitting right that kind of managerial discretion. When this is part of the fundamental problem.
I think teachers, at least the ones who I talk to, say, "Oh, I don't want it. I don't want my principal. They can hold a grudge." I mean, teachers buy into that notion that their principal could sort of mm-hmm. screw them over for a personal reason.
Fair, I mean, our leadership tends to be remarkably mm-hmm. untalented.
All right, but everybody who has a boss has that fear that their boss can make a dumb decision.
You work for Checker Finn, absolutely.
Enough said. Okay.
Strangely silent.
I'm trying to practice the awkward pause. Yes, that I've learned from you, Rick. Okay, Amber, what song goes with this?
All right. So just like this performance-based pay system has nothing to do with real merit pay, this song has nothing to do with our research minute. We are paying homage to rapper Nate Dogg, who died today.
Regulators. You regulate any stealing of his property. We're damn good, too. But you can't be any geek off the street. Gotta be handy with the steel, if you know what I mean, earn your keep.
Regulators! Mount up! It was a clear black night, a clear white moon. Warren G was on the streets, trying to consume some skirts for the E, so I could get some phones. Rolling in my ride, chilling all alone.
Just hit the east side of the LBC, on a mission trying to find Mr. Warren G. Seen a car full of girls, ain't no need to tweak. All of you skirts know what's up with 213.
So I hustle out. I woke up this morning and I got out of bed. Had a big old cup of coffee to clear my head. Telephone rang and you wanna chat? Well, sit on down and tell me what up with that? What up with that? Yes, sir.
Anyone who has worked in a 21st century high school classroom can probably attest to the fact that language used by many students would not be allowed at grandma's dinner table. While coarse language is unacceptable at most schools, it's not easy to control. Despite the difficulty, North Mesquite High School in suburban Dallas has devised a plan to make those foul-mouthed students pay, literally. Victoria Mullins was one of the first students impacted by the school's new policy. After yelling, "You trying to start at a fellow student in class," Mullins was sent to see the school resource officer, who issued her a ticket for disorderly conduct / abusive language. The fine for Mullins' ticket ended up being $637. A $637 swear word? What's up with that? Well, this time I'll tell you what's up with that. Pure ingenuity. Let's be honest. Loss of participation points, timeouts, detentions, suspensions, none of these actually leave an impression beyond the day they occur. I can guarantee Victoria Mullins, who consequently had to take on a waitressing job, will never utter a profanity again without thinking about the $637 it cost her that one time. Seeing this makes me wonder, what else could we be fining students for?
Now, Rick, if this was in place, for education policy thinkers, you would be fined a lot of money.
That would be expensive, man.
I mean, I feel like I hear you curse at least 17 times in an average hour-long meeting that I've joined you for.
Well, and I got to say that high school was much worse, man. I would have been one broke-ass kid, I'll tell you
there,
what.
Boom. $637 right there.
You got to be kidding me. Dude, you know what kind of cake you got to generate? Oh, man. And, there's a fundamental bias here. This is biased towards people who have strong religious backgrounds and against those of us who are, lost souls.
Uh-huh.
That's just not fair.
Do you think this would change your behavior, that this would have worked as an incentive?
It would have definitely had me in the poorhouse. So I would probably be stealing stuff out of garbage cans. Yeah.
And that you would have been totally then, huh?
Oh!
Just kidding. Joe can bleep that one out. Okay. That's all the time we got for this week. Until next week.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute's Education Gadfly Show, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.